Fixing hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an FU commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part two.
I'm Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, the worldwide leader in sports, coming to you live from suburban Chicago, part of the Chicagoland area. Yeah, that's where I am.
I'm Ryan Lambert. I'm at my apartment that I live at.
Sean McAndrew in Ottawa at the Puck Soup recording studio in my dining room.
And you're in Puck Soup. I will say that fans of dogs barking during the podcast are probably going to like this one. We bought sneakers to meet her cousins, a.k.a. Ruby's dog she grew up with, plus a rescue dog named Simon, who's the sweetest little guy. And, yeah, they all fucking hate each other. It's pretty great. Simon and Sneakers get along together, but the other two dogs that live in this house and Sneakers are not fans of each other. And I will say this, the extra stress of the situation is that it's Sneakers' fault. Like, she's being a total dickhead to these dogs, and that's the real crushing part. It's like when you go to, like, school and you hear that your kid got into a fight, not saying this ever happened to my kid, and then you find out that it's, like, your kid's the instigator, should have gotten the 2 minutes. It's the same kind of situation with this dog. I feel really bad about it.
Sounds like somebody is ready for a head coaching career in the NHL.
That's right. I need her to list all of the dogs in the house, from the dog who chases the ball best to the dog that doesn't give the best effort, and then we'll go from there.
Yes.
But King of Transitions brings us to one of many of the incredible stories that has happened since our last episode, which is the Bostonian-like trashing of Mike Babcock as he leaves town. I have to hand it to the Toronto media. You maybe are outdoing your friends to the south in throwing somebody under the bus after the bus has already left. This week's big nugget was the psychological warfare waged by Mike Babcock, who, by the way, went to McGill for sports psychology. Don't know if you guys knew that. In having Mitch Marner, correct me if I'm wrong on this story, he had Mitch Marner as a rookie list all of his teammates from the ones who give the most effort to the ones that don't.
That's right.
And then shared that with Nazem Kadri, with the people.
And allegedly Tyler Bozak. Those were the two.
shared that with the people at the bottom of the list.
Yeah,
correct.
I will say this first about Mike Babcock in this situation. This is dumb. It is divisive. I see in no way, shape, and form how this could possibly have helped the Leafs. But I do respect the abject, sinister nature of what he's done here in trying to motivate veteran players by basically sacrificing the reputation of a star rookie in the process. There's a certain, I appreciate the Lex Lutherism here aspect, I have to admit, personally.
Oh, I think it sucks. I think it's borderline abusive to be like, hey, it's just between you and me, baby, and then, you know, share it, like, post it online or whatever the fuck, you know, that it's obviously shitty. No, like, and you can tell it's obviously shitty because nobody in the hockey media is defending it. Not one person is like, you know, maybe not the worst way to motivate. No, everybody's like, yeah, this was really bad to do. Like, why? I don't know what he was thinking.
Yeah. And it's weird because it seems like stunning and yet also probably not. Like, I haven't seen anybody defend it, but I also haven't seen anybody say, like, I have never heard of anything like this. This is so out of character for NHL coach. Like, in fact, there's a bunch of people who've invoked names like Mike Keenan and stuff like that, saying that sounds like the sort of thing that they would have done too. Not that they necessarily did, but that there's just certain guys.
It's in their wheelhouse. Yeah,
it's interesting because you always hear about players not liking coaches, you know, and this guy's not that. Players couldn't stand him, but we very rarely get this kind of detailed look at at something like that. And yeah. it's been interesting because I am not sure if I can recall a case of a coach being fired and having this many sound bites floating around from the players themselves in the days afterwards that make it clear that they really didn't like this guy. Like, I don't feel like anyone's, they're not necessarily knifing him on the way out the door, but just the comments about Sheldon Keefe and how, like, oh, it's going to be fun to play hockey again, and he's going to actually listen to us and let us, you know, like, it feels, maybe it's just because I'm a Leaf fan, I'm paying closer attention, but it feels like this is above and beyond what you usually get. So it's very clear that Babcock was not well liked. Something like this would certainly contribute to that.
But don't you think ultimately this it's clearly part of a pile on and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy got fired and, you know, he comes in riding on a huge ego and then fails. So I think that anytime you have that happen, it's going to be a pile on. But don't you think a lot of the reaction to this is less about, the act itself and more about, let's just see how much fucking dirt we can pile on this guy's grave?
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact that this came out when it did, and I, like, let's be clear on how this came out, because there's this implication that everyone in the Toronto media already knew about this, and they only talked about it after he was already gone, which is certainly something that does happen in the media world. But in this case, at least, the guy who reported it, Terry Koshan at the Toronto Sun, he was very clear when he wrote about it on the weekend. He said, I only heard about this a couple days ago. So clearly somebody with the Leafs or somebody who was close to the situation decided to spill this to the media. And
right.
And then they ran with it. Like, it wasn't a case where this wasn't the old, like, oh, well, here's a story I heard 3 years ago. And you're sitting there going, well, why didn't you tell us that story 3 years ago then? Because it seemed like it would have been newsworthy. In this case, at least, with the Big Marner story, it sounds like this was something that only came out, which means somebody either in the organization or close to Mitch Marner or who had been close to the situation at the time it happened decided that now was a good time to put it out there and probably did so knowing how bad it would make Mike Babcock look.
Thanks, Paul.
The thing I want to say about it too, though, is like all this stuff coming out after the fact and that kind of thing. Like, yeah, it's a little bit throwing a guy under the bus, but also it's like, well, look, there is probably a pretty vocal segment of the Maple Leafs fan base who is like, you know, it's the lazy player's fault. It's not genius Coke Mike Babcock's. You know, like, it's not his fault they're right. underperforming. And so, like, now somebody has to go, no, like, this is why we all hated this guy's fucking guts. Like,
yeah, right. It could be. Like, and I'm not going to – I don't want to get into too much speculation over where the story came from.
Sure.
I'll just point out that there were two other players named as being directly involved, and the Leafs did play Colorado on Saturday.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring that up too. Yeah, I don't think that was too much.
It may not necessarily have been somebody directly inside the Leafs organization at this time, but even if it wasn't, like, there again, like, just the comments and quotes. Like, usually you get at least the standard, like, hey, this is a reflection on all of us, and it's tough to see anybody lose. And I think, like, we kind of got that from Tavares a little bit, playing the captain's role, but I
yeah Tavares was like, I didn't like hate him, I mean,
yeah. But everybody else is like,
I didn't hate him yeah. him, but
everybody else is like, I don't know what it is, it's just the last few days, like, I'm happy to wake up in the morning and I don't want to quit my job and go work in a mill anymore.
Tavares pulled the I'm a well-wisher in that I do not wish him any specific harm.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So,
Sean, you bring up an interesting point, though. I mean, like, how if this was Keenan, or if this was Ken Hitchcock, right? And if this wasn't Babcock, where something like this is used as a needle to puncture the myth balloon, right? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, would we be seeing this story any differently?
Well, I mean, here's what I'll say. I think we would be seeing the story differently if the Leafs had won. And if the Leafs were winning right now, I mean, we probably would never have heard this story, but if we did years down the line, it'd be viewed differently. And the example of that, that's kind of sticking with me over the last few days is another one of the things that's come up after he was fired is people looking back at him not putting Jason Spezza in the lineup against the Senators on opening night. If people don't remember this, the Leafs are hosting the Senators on opening night. Jason Spezza, obviously a longtime Senator star, has just signed with the Leafs. He's a hometown kid. It's his, in theory, debut as a Maple Leaf. He's going to do it on Hockey Night in Canada in front of his old team. And Babcock leaves him out of the lineup and then dresses him the next night and basically says, well, we got a rotation of fourth line guys. And a lot of people were like, well, if you got a rotation, why wouldn't you put the veteran in the game that he clearly wanted to play? And a lot of people now are viewing that as this was just classic Babcock power trip. He just had to be a jerk for the sake of it. That's a great way to lose the room and all of that. And yeah, it probably is all of those things. But if the Maple Leafs were in first place in the Eastern Conference right now, people would be looking back at that and going, that was a great moment. Mike Babcock demonstrated to this young team that nobody's above the team and it's all about winning and it's all about having the best lineup in any given night and nobody has anything that they didn't earn and blah, 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 blah. There's ways that you can always twist this stuff when it works. But when it doesn't work, it looks awful.
And well, right, but that's the point, though. Like, it didn't work because he did this shit. Like, he's
like,
not a master
Scotty
motivator.
How many Bowman stories do you think there must be?
Yeah.
Like, in this ballpark. I mean, that guy was hated by his players always, right up until it was time to get their Stanley Cup rings.
Right.
And so, you know, any stories that we have heard about Bowman are always, like, kind of tinted through, yeah, but he knew what he was doing because it worked. And you know, with Mike Babcock, maybe it did work for a while. Maybe, I don't know, maybe this whole incident helped Mitch Marner get to it. I don't know. Doesn't sound like it.
Damian Coxian on that one right there. Yeah, Damian's theory is that since Marner had a great, you know, start to his career, being that he's got God-given talent and played with John Tavares, that obviously it's Babcock's psychological warfare that made him the player that he is today.
Well, there you go. The other theory that's floating around out there and that it's at least interesting is a lot of people are looking back going, maybe now it makes a lot more sense that all of these young Leaf star players seemed to really want to get maximum money and not take any kind of hometown discount and not kind of give... maybe if you really hate your boss and you hate coming into work, that might explain why you would drive a harder bargain when it comes to some of that stuff. So I don't know. It doesn't sound like it was a good situation. So now Sheldon Keefe gets to come in and be the good cop. And we'll see. We're two games in. The Leafs have looked pretty good in both games, won two games. So everything's great. If they go on another losing streak, suddenly it's going to be, oh, the inmates are running the asylum and maybe Babcock had the right idea and all of that. Like, it's just one of those things where it's like we look at the win-loss record first and then we retcon the narratives to fit the behaviors, which is probably the wrong way to do it, but it's always how we do it.
That's the absolute truth. I mean, listen, I've said on this show many times I am not a Mike Babcock super fan, right? Like, I think that his reputation is really overinflated to the point of almost being fraudulent. But I think he's a good coach. And I lobbied for him to win the Jack Adams in 2017 because I thought he did that good of a job with the Leafs that year. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it, you could say... yeah, maybe not so good, and especially with some of his personnel decisions, especially apparently with what was going on behind the scenes. But I do think that clearly the needle is all the way in the red right now on the fucking trashing of Mike Babcock. Yes. I feel like there's going to be a boomeranging back at some point, but right now it is just like DEFCON 5 as far as the amount of shit he's taking as a coach.
Well, and
so I guess my question is it enough where his reputation has taken too much of a hit where, like, you know, I saw Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times be like, it could still be Babcock here in Seattle. But does this affect it at all? Or is the myth of Mike Babcock still in place and people are going to see this as a Toronto problem?
No, I don't think it's going to be a Toronto problem. But I think it could be a short-term problem. This is the sort of thing that if I was a team, if I'm the Nashville Predators and I was really thinking about firing Peter Laviolette and hiring Mike Babcock, I might be more hesitant to do that right now. I might sit there and go, you know what? We need to let this cool off a bit. But if I'm in the 2020 offseason and I need a coach, I'm not sure that I'm going to be too concerned, especially because by that point, he'll be able to say, you know what? I went off. I went skiing. I went hunting. I thought about it. I realized I did make some mistakes and I'm a new guy now, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just, it is interesting because even like Babcock is like kind of texting out these responses to reporters. And according to him, at least, he says that he apologized, which, and then Brendan Shanahan said that, I guess, Lou Lamoriello got involved. So that shows you that this was a big deal, because Mike Babcock doesn't strike me as an apology sort of guy. Let's just say he seems like the sort of guy who just does what he thinks is best, and then that's how it goes. So the fact that he either understood or was made to understand that he had screwed up, it kind of gives you a sense of how rough this was. I just, you know, and as I said on Twitter, all my sympathy to Mitch Marner, as somebody who spends an inordinate amount of time making ranked lists of people, and then getting criticized for it. I really emphasize with him, the plight of having your rankings, carved up in front of you.
Would you hire Mike Babcock if you were a GM, Ryan?
No. You know, I just don't think, well, okay. If I'm a GM of, say, a typical NHL team, I probably don't. But I think that Mike Babcock's whole bullshit, kind of works with more veteran guys, which is what, say, Seattle is in line to get in a couple of years. So, like, if I'm Seattle, I'm probably thinking about it just, A, you know, there is that name recognition, and B, like, he has a proven track record of getting success with more, let's say, more veteran teams.
Yeah. Although the weird thing about that is, like, you're right. That's what he did in Detroit. That's kind of what he did in Anaheim. Certainly, Team Canada was always just packed.
And early on, well, like, I'm talking about the first year in Toronto, though. Like, that was more of a veteran team than, you know, the influx of kids they eventually got.
It was kind of weird because the thinking when they first hired Mike Babcock in Toronto, the thinking was, okay, this could be a great hire eventually, but, you know, they're in rebuild mode. They're in, like, climbing out of the ashes right now. Is he going to be the right coach for that? Yeah, he'd be great when they're good and they've got talent and they're ready to be a cup contender, but can he get them there? And in hindsight, he did a perfect job getting them there. And then once they were there, he was the absolute wrong guy. And you're right. The Leafs are an unusual contender in that they're much younger, especially as far as their key players, than a typical contender would be. But yeah, I mean, I still think if I'm a Nashville or a San Jose or somebody where the window is open right now, I could probably talk myself into it, even though, you know, there's going to be better candidates out there.
Right.
I would imagine.
Like we've said on the show before, like, he is overrated, but he's not like a bad coach or anything. Like, he's just not a top three coach in the world. Is he a top eight coach? Yeah, probably. So,
but, like, you know, the idea that we're putting him on a Scotty Bowman level or a Joel Quenneville level, like, I just don't buy it. I just feel like he has been one of the luckiest sons of bitches in this game.
Yeah, for
sure. As far as, like, the opportunities that he's gotten and the people that he's worked with. And I think the fact is that he's been exposed, especially as a postseason coach, since Nick Lidstrom retired.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like it's hard for me to jibe with that. But I agree with you, though. Like, the pile-on is a little bit too much right now as far as he being a shit coach.
And the other thing is, as far as how much this sticks to his reputation, one two-minute soundbite from Mitch Marner can make a lot of this go away. Like, if Mitch Marner were to come out and say, you know what, I wasn't comfortable with it at the time. It was a rough moment, but I do think ultimately it helped me, or Mike Babcock did more, you know, did more to help me than to harm me. And I'm the player I am now, partly because he took a hard line. Like, if he says something like that, that kind of gives the blank check to a whole bunch of
and
DMs
the good
to
news
go
is,
forget about it.
I bet he's very inclined to do that for Mike Babcock, his close personal friend.
He may or may not be. And that's the other thing is that he's not, because he's injured right now, he's not you know, having to talk to the media all the time. So they haven't really got that directly from him. But it's been an interesting week in Toronto. Like I you're right. Like you kind of mentioned it, Greg. Like we expect this these days when somebody with a big name and a big reputation gets fired, that the Knives or traded or whatever, that the Knives kind of come out. But this has been different, or at least it feels a little bit different, because I think a lot of these stories weren't known, or at least no one specifically enough to report on, and now they're coming out.
That brings up a final point about this, which I think is interesting. Bob McKenzie, according to this one tweet that I see, it was on TSN 1050 recently, and says he doesn't like dropping stories about coaches when they're fired because it's piling on. You can't report it right after it happens for access privacy, right after the incident happens for access privacy reasons. Can't report it after because it's piling on. When's the right time to expose a story like this? Like, for those, I goof on the ones who knew and didn't say anything because I just hate the fucking, you know, thing that a lot of reporters, a lot of very senior reporters do, where it's like, well, I knew this news before it came out, and I'm going to put in this tweet that I knew it, even though I didn't report it. But at least I knew it, and you should all know that I'm very good at my job. I fucking hate that. And I feel like there's a lot of that going on with this Babcock stuff. But at the same time, like, it is a very sensitive story to try to go after if you're a beat, if you're a beat reporter in that city.
And here's the thing. It's sensitive for all the – like, I think a lot of fans maybe don't necessarily understand how some of this comes together, because yes, there is all the things that you assume, right? There's access, there is like, who am I going to tick off if I report this story and he's still the coach? Am I now, you know, I'm making it difficult to do my own job, and maybe I also don't want to deal with him yelling at me or, you know, embarrassing me in front
making
of my
you give him a list of all the of other beat stuff. Reporters who work hard.
Yeah, exactly. But there is also an element of this where sometimes you hear things that you can't report on because they're just not because you choose not to, because there's just not enough there. Like there are times where you might hear, you know, a year ago, you might go, oh yeah, Babcock, he's doing pretty good in Toronto. And somebody might go, yeah, but I don't think the players really like him. And you go, oh yeah, what do you mean? And they go, well, there's just some stuff has gone on. There's been some stuff. Well, you can't, there's nothing there for you to report. There's nothing you can run with as a story. But then a year later, when it comes out, maybe in an offhand way, you say, yeah, I had heard rumblings of this sort of thing. And now suddenly everyone's jumping on you going, why didn't you report it? Because hearing rumblings or hearing pieces of something is not enough to actually go and put something in a newspaper or on a website or on Twitter or wherever it is. So I do feel like, yeah, absolutely, it does happen sometimes that people just bag something because out of their own self-interest. But also sometimes you just don't have enough to go out as a story until somebody gets more and is able to confirm it. And that's just kind of how the job works.
Yeah.
You know, CJ had CJ compile the list, and he said that, sorry, Sean McKenzie, you are the least motivated guy in the media.
I'd fucking love to have seen that. I just want it. I want a Toronto list. Who'd be the snitch? Would it be Myrtle?
No.
No.
Myrtle's
a company man. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Babcock, what are you going to do? I think at the end of the day, like I said, it's a pile on right now. There's a lot there, but no one – he dug his own grave. You know, no one's going to say that Mike Babcock got the shaft.
Well,
speaking of shaft, today's episode of Buck Soup is sponsored by Manscaped.
Wow.
Fellas.
Okay. Yeah?
Yeah, I mean,
it's time
you,
to gear
well,
up.
I mean, no.
It's
no.
time to gear up. It's time to gear up and get yourself the gift of shaving this holiday season. I'm talking about the Manscaped Perfect Package 2.0. Folks, occasionally you're going to have to clear out the brush. You're going to have to get to that lawn, tend it well, make everybody see how pretty your house looks. You know what I'm trying to say? It's good for hygiene. It's good for aesthetics. And Manscaped's Perfect Package 2.0 is the perfect gift this holiday season. It's literally everything you need to keep trimmed, cut free, oh, that's important, and smelling nice down there. It comes with the Lawnmower 2.0, which has proprietary advanced skin-safe technology, so it won't snag. So let's review briefly. no snags, no cuts, and you'll smell good. I'm trying to figure out what the downside here is. It's waterproof as well, so you can use it in the shower. Are you guys shaving the shower, guys? By the way, I'm not talking on the downstairs. I'm talking on the upstairs.
No.
Yes. 100% shaving the shower.
Very interesting. As you know, for a while, Sean Leahy was my hetero life partner on the road, and he was a shave in the shower guy, and I never really liked it because I always found it too difficult to keep the little mirror unfogged, and I certainly wasn't going to do it freehand. But then I shaved in the shower recently when we were taking our vacation, and I found it to be like the tightest, greatest, closest shave I ever got. So I may have to change my habits here. Is that how you find it?
Yeah. And no cleanup. And also I don't need a mirror. My chin and jaw have not moved in many, many years. They're still in the same place, and I'm not doing like any sort of fancy styling. Shave in the shower. Step out, clean it up a little bit if you need to, and then you're all good to go.
See, this is the issue with me, though, because I'm a Wyszynski and have those genes. My facial silhouette is that of a bowl of mashed potatoes, so I can't really shave freehand in the shower without some mirror guidance, I think. I think I'd fuck it up pretty bad. But anyways, that's good insight. The Perfect Package 2.0 also includes the crop preserver. Now, you might be thinking this is some sort of a biplane that flies over your genitals and drops chemicals. No, the crop preserver is an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer and boxer briefs that will keep you feeling fresh all day. So you get the boxer briefs and the thing that will make your balls not smell, which is, you know, important. Manscaped products are now also available in Target stores. Just go to the person at Target and say, I have a question about my balls, and they'll tell you exactly where to go. Tis the season to get Manscaped, so get yourself, your dad, your brother, your friends. Is this a gift that you'd give a friend, Ryan? A big old manscaping package?
You know, Greg, as a general rule, I don't give my friends gifts. My friendship is gift enough, I would say.
That's very true. And also keeps their ball smelling nice. Our listeners will receive 20% off free shipping when you use the code PUCK at manscaped.com. That's manscaped.com. Use the promo code PUCK. That's 20% off plus free shipping when you use promo code PUCK at manscaped.com. Manscaped, a proud sponsor and comedy partner of the Puck Soup podcast. One other Babcock fallout thing we should talk about, but it's a tough one to talk about, not only because of the subject matter, but because it's not a story that's really broken all the way yet, as we do the podcast on this Tuesday before Turkey Day in America. That'd be Bill Peters being accused by Akeem Alou, who played for Peters with the Rockford Ice Hogs, the AHL affiliate of the Chicago Blackhawks in 2009-2010, putting on Twitter last night, not very surprising, the things we're hearing about Babcock, apple doesn't fall far from the tree, same sort of deal with his protege in Calgary, dropped the N-bomb several times towards me in the dressing room in my rookie year because he didn't like my choice of music. So on and so forth. As we've done the podcast, the Calgary Flames last night didn't make Bill Peters available after their game against the Penguins. Brad Treliving instead met the media and, you know, gave the "we're going to investigate this" platitudes you'd expect. The National Hockey League came out with a statement right as we were about to do the show that stated, "The behavior that has been alleged is repugnant and unacceptable. We have no further comment until we have an opportunity to look into the matter more." Kind of getting ahead of the story and doing what the NHL does in these situations, which is pay lip service to a problem, but probably never doing anything themselves, but instead have the team handle it. It's a nasty one, folks, and I'm not quite sure how this is all going to work out if proven true.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is, as you say, it's a weird one to talk about now because we're doing this Tuesday morning, and there's a good chance that by the time people hear this, the story may have taken more turns and we may already be out of date on it. It's the kind of thing, yeah, that they're going to investigate. Presumably that's going to involve talking to members of that team. Akeem Alou didn't go into detail in the tweet, and I don't think he's at least publicly gone into any more detail about the circumstances around the incident. He says it happened in the dressing room, which implies that other people would have been around, or maybe even the entire team would have been there. in which case there will absolutely be people who heard it, and they will tell the Flames or the NHL that. And if that's the case, then I think that's going to be the end of Bill Peters in Calgary. I don't know how you can have a coach stay on the job under those circumstances. If it was some other set of circumstances, if it was more of a private conversation, obviously that gets more complicated. We'll have to see. It's going to be something that you don't want to give too much credit for putting out PR statements. It does sound like it's being taken seriously, and they're going to look at it. But yeah, if this ends up being verified and other people come forward and saying, yeah, I heard this, then I have a very hard time imagining that Bill Peters can continue in this role.
What do you think, Ryan?
Yeah, no, I think that all sounds correct. Greg, you put up a poll on Twitter earlier today of, like, what do you think is, you know, going to happen with this? And one was, you know, act like nothing happened, which they can't do. And the second one, which I kind of think would happen if maybe the team was playing better, is, you know, public apology, press tour kind of a thing. And, you know, I'm a different guy now, all that kind of shit. And then, you know, the last one was firing him. And I think the combination of how they're not good this year and the whole circumstances around the allegations, which, you know, I would have no reason to disbelieve, certainly. But yeah, I think that just makes it kind of a no-brainer for the Flames.
It wasn't so much ignore it as it was deny it. And I think that, you know, going under the auspices for a moment that this is true, if it's a one-on-one conversation and Bill Peters knows it's a one-on-one conversation, you can deny it. And then it becomes a he said,
right?
And you move on. But then you run the risk of A, someone having overheard it, or B, this being perhaps not the only instance in which the word was used in the life of a guy.
Well, he said several times, like he even said, like Akeem Alou said, like several times. He didn't say it happened once, and everybody was like,
right,
"What are
exactly.
you doing?" You know.
Yeah, but do you think that this could again? We talked about this with the Don Cherry stuff, and really cutting to the bone on why these decisions are made. It's very hard to not see the business aspect of this, where your team is in a spiral and your coach may have just done something that, I don't know, could potentially offer you cover to fire him. I mean, it's not impossible to see a scenario play out that way, is there?
No, I think it's a pretty likely outcome, is because it's like, well, you know, earlier this week, Treliving said, you know, we're not firing the coach and we're not trading any major players. And it's like, well, then it sounds like you don't have any plans to fix anything that's wrong with your team, is what it sounds like to me. But, you know, now, well, you know, you don't have to worry about how bad it looks if you fire a coach who got you to first in the West last year.
Yeah, I wrote a post that went up like a few hours before this story broke. Where I was listing coaches, like who's going to be the next coach fired after Mike Babcock, and Bill Peters was prominently on the list. So it shouldn't make a difference, but it probably does. If the Flames are first place overall and they're rolling, yeah, maybe it does get viewed differently. But they're not, and if there's confirmation. And we'll underline the if, because this is, again, a story with moving parts, and, you know, it's a serious accusation, and we don't want to go and convict anyone before it's time to do that. But if it does turn out to be verified,
that's it. You can't.
I would hope that's it. And maybe, you know, I've my capacity to be surprised by how this league works sometimes nothing that they can do would really stun me, but I would be surprised, because this is it's an extremely serious accusation. Not just what he said, which obviously in any context would be awful, but it sounds at least like this was said like in anger, singling out a player potentially in front of his hit. Like there's no way you can come back and say, well, it was a misunderstanding or it was heat of the moment. Like there's just nothing. Not that there would be under other contexts, but there's you don't even have a starting point here. Yeah. If it played out the way it sounds like from the limited information we have, the way it sounds like it did.
And oh boy, Knives Out, not just a Rian Johnson film coming out this week. It is what is happening to Bill Peters as we speak in this podcast. Sean McMorrow, who played for Peters with the Rockford IceHogs in 2008-2009, has hit Twitter. He's a pro player that's bounced around a little bit in the world. If you think Mike Commodore has had harsh words for Babcock, you're in for a treat to hear what I would have to say about Bill Peters. Worst human being to ever coach me. Treated me terrible on an AHL team where I won a league award for community service.
Jeez.
So here we go, baby. Floodgates are open.
Yeah.
Kind of crazy. He had a lack of success in Carolina. Maybe, and this is just me, maybe they just needed a different coach.
You know, honestly, I was thinking about that because when all this came out last night, I was like, oh yeah, I feel like I heard everybody in Carolina hated his guts.
Yeah, and then they bought in an ex-player that everybody fucking liked, and they became a goddamn juggernaut.
Yeah, yeah, it's, like, you know, like, you wonder, right? Because, you know, like the extent to which players hating a coach matters is clearly, like, you can see it in the numbers with Babcock, with Peters, where, like, they're just like, I don't exactly know how to phrase it, but like it seems like there's a tangible, like, you know, statistical return on that.
Two things on this, by the way. First of all, and I think Sean, you'll agree, one of my favorite things about hockey is the good cop, bad cop hiring and firing of coaches. This has been a tradition for years, where you bring in the taskmaster scumbag, and then the guy that replaces him is like a dude they used to play with 5 years ago as like a sixth defenseman, like a total player's guy, a dude they all like, the assistant coach they all like.
Or the assistant coach that they all liked.
Yeah, the good cop. Yeah. Like, I remember as a kid, the first time I ever realized this was like growing up when the Devils bought in Tom McVie to be the head coach a few times, like Lou bought him in. And I had no idea who Tom McVie was, except for this reputation that he had, that he was like a fucking drill sergeant, right? And then whenever he get fired, they bring in a guy and it's like, this is the player's coach. That dynamic in hockey has always been really fascinating to me. And it kind of played out, I think, in Carolina pretty well, where they bring in Rod Brindamore
and replace sometimes Bill Peters. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Because I remember the prior to Mike Babcock, the most hated coach I've ever seen in Toronto was Pat Burns by the end. Mm. In fact, there was a story that I don't even know if it was his birthday or something, but that like the players got together and had a cake delivered to his hotel room. And when he opened it up, in the icing on the cake, it said, "We all hate you."
We all hate you. Yeah.
Which is subtle, but seems negative. Which is crazy. And then they brought in Mike Murphy, who was like the assistant that everyone liked. And they were terrible for 2 years. It was just a disaster. And then they brought in Pat Quinn, who was, you know, a little, again, not always a player's favorite guy. And they were good again. So, you know, it's this yin and yang. You sort of go back and forth.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, any coach is going to have some guys that like him and some that don't. And I can see this kind of can of worms opening up where now this is turning into the airing of the grievances for every player who played for a coach they didn't like. And we should just, you know, we should be a little careful with that, because especially when you're talking about AHL guys, where if you're a coach in the AHL, where some guys are fast tracked to the big leagues and some guys just aren't going to make it. I don't care how wonderful a human being you are. There's going to be some of those guys who look back and resent you and feel like they didn't get a shot and feel like they weren't treated well, and that it cost them a career, and they're going to hate you. And that, to me, you know, just hearing that somebody was a jerk or somebody wasn't your favorite coach in the minors mm-hmm. is I hope we don't lump all of this in together with what Akeem Alou is talking about, which is a very different
right
class and a very different level of
For sure
of behavior.
Yeah. But I think it continues though that the probably like decade long trend now of this shit's just not going to fly anymore when it comes to coaches and their bullshit. Whether it's as extreme as Bill Peters' alleged bullshit or as almost by the numbers psychological warfare bullshit of Mike Babcock, it just seems like that type of coach can no longer exist in this modern athlete era.
We'll see. But
it's all these entitled millennials who don't like to be emotionally abused, right?
Bill Belichick's the exception to the rule. That, I mean, that guy can Palpatine it up as much as he wants.
Well, but again, it's because wins constantly. Yeah. I think that's the mm-hmm. only difference between him and these mm-hmm. other guys.
All right. One more topic before we get to our guest. That's the Robert Bortuzzo suspension and its various fallout. I said 4 games when I saw the act after I saw the injury and reconsidered the intent on the play. I'd go 6. I know that's probably way lower than a lot of people wanted. I saw people saying 15 for Bortuzzo for what he did, like with some sort of Vachta math equation that they were doing. I know you wanted 10. I know that you and I disagree. I think on a lot of player safety stuff. That's understandable. Sean, what did you think as far as suspension?
I mean, I thought it was low, but I think most of the suspensions are low. And I think in this case, particularly because he has a history of doing this same thing. And it was, when you look at the play, like it's the first cross check. I know it sounds ridiculous to say where he cross checks a guy face first into the crossbar. Like that still kind of falls into the category of a hockey play, even though it's an illegal hockey play that is a penalty. But, you know, that kind of stuff happens in the crease in front of the net. But then to look over, see the ref is calling a penalty, give this exaggerated reaction, and then very clearly make the calculation that, well, I'm going to get my money's worth and deliver a shot that is intended, maybe not intent to injure, but it's intent to hurt. Like you're doing like this is like, all right. And I think there was also maybe a feeling like Arvidsson had kind of sold it a little bit. And so it was sort of like, all right, you're going to sell it. I'm going to give you something to sell. I think there was, even under the standards of what the Department of Player Safety typically does, there was room to go higher here. But it was within range of what they typically give. For like 4 games is a very big suspension under the current system. And I just, it feels like every time something happens, everybody's upset that the number is too low. And at some point we just got to go like, this is the system. Like if you want, and I'm not saying that we just throw up our hands and accept it. I'm saying this now in mid-November is not the time to be mad that the suspensions are too low. To give you an example, I think the NHL's current point system is stupid. I think they should go to a 3-point system. I think it's ridiculous that we give loser points for losing in overtime and that some games are worth more than others. I feel very strongly about that. Some people agree with me. Some people don't. I think I'm right. But when I'm watching the Leafs play and they win in regulation, I don't sit there and go, how come they didn't get 3 points for that win? That's crazy. I'm really mad about that because I know how the current system works. And it would be ridiculous of me to expect in the middle of a season that the system would somehow act differently. This is how it works now. I think it could work better in a different way, but we don't have the different way. So we've got what we've got now. And the Department of Player Safety, I would like to see bigger suspensions. I would love to see 10 games for something like this. But that's not how it works right now. And the reason it doesn't work that way is not because there's 3 or 4 guys at the Department of Player Safety who just really like violence. It's because their bosses are 31... soon to be 32 GMs who don't want heavy suspensions for this stuff. And until that changes and they get a directive, I'm sure these guys would be more than happy to drop 10 game bombs on people. If that was the directive they were given by their bosses, it hasn't happened. That's not what the system is. And I don't understand why we insist on doing this dance every single time there's a suspension that falls well within the range of what we should expect given the entire history of how this has worked for years.
That's a great point. And I think if you want to be outraged about a cross-check discipline and it being too light, go back to the Brock Nelson one that he had 2 years ago, where, like Sean said, it was the exact same type of situation, cross-check down to the ice, and then he gave him several shots after he was down on the ice to his mm-hmm. back. It's kind of like the Bortuzzo move. That was a fine. And so if your starting point is a fine and then you go to four, well, that's a pretty significant increase in the world of player safety. If that had been maybe a game or two and then you go up to six or seven for this, then it makes a bit more logical sense within the parameters that they've set. But the fact mm-hmm. of the matter is that a lot of the shit that should get a suspension gets a fine. And that's the part – like I'm a player safety defender. I think they do a good job for the most part. But there's a lot of shit that just gets fined that I don't understand why the fuck it's a fine. I really don't.
Yeah, and I think part of that is they've, over the years, kind of evolved into this reluctance to necessarily give one game. It seems like there's this feeling that if we're going to give something, it should be multiple games, and if not, if it's going to be one, then let's just do a fine. And a lot of times they look at, well, was there a penalty in the game? And if the guy got ejected, that's kind of like he got a game already. So, and yeah, I mean, this is... Again, like I'm not sitting here saying that we should just shrug and say, oh, this is just how it is. You know, absolutely. Get out there, bang the drum, say that the numbers across the board need to be higher. We need to have a different way of doing this. But first of all, understand the root of the problem, which is it's the GMs and the teams. And to some extent also the Players Association, although they're in a weird spot where they have to defend their guys and they have certain obligations and as far as appeals processes and that kind of thing. It's not just the Department of Player Safety. They're running the system that the league wants. And under that system, this is probably a 4-game suspension. Well, maybe
so
five
the other,
or six.
The other problem with it, obviously, is that, you know, when people were like, this should be 5 games, this should be 7 games, whatever people said, there were a bunch of chuds on Twitter who were like, well, look, the guy is in the crease, and if you go in the crease you get shot in the face with a bazooka, that's fine because you were near the goalie. And like, if you don't think that figures into the player safety aspect of it, like you're like I think that's incredibly naive that like
those guys are all Blues fans, and I sit here and roll my eyes at it, but Maple Leaf who does it tonight, then it's going to be all Leaf fans who are going to be mad, and like everybody thinks we want high suspensions until it's your team.
But the thing, it wasn't just Blues fans. It was a bunch of fucking, like I got like Leafs fans and Flames fans in my mentions because I said like this shit should not be part of the game, and they were like, well, look, you know, you've obviously never played hockey because blah blah blah. Yeah, and
right,
because
these beer league tough guys,
right? Yeah, beer league tough guys who play in no checking leagues. But you know, like it's a thing where, you know, if you think the people in player safety don't feel the exact same way about a guy being around your goalie in the crease, whatever, like, that's naive. Like, they obviously feel that way because that's how they think the game works.
No, that's a fair point. And I, you know, that's sort of the Neanderthalic guys running the player safety argument Ken Campbell makes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've always, you know, in fairness, like I've always thought, I never really understood why they don't have that competing philosophy in that room.
Well, because,
not necessarily
because
to run
to
the,
Sean's
run the,
point, then they'd have somebody going, you know, that should be 10 fucking games. He clearly tried to injure his opponent and succeeded.
Which they should have. I don't think Paul Kariya should run player safety. I do like the idea of you hire the hacker to protect your system, right? Like, I like the idea of there being a guy that played a little dirty looking at a play and being like, I know exactly what this guy was trying to do here. That's always been something that I'm okay with, but I never understood why they don't have more competing philosophies
in
that room when it comes
to
player safety.
Then they might start spitting out higher suspension numbers, mm-hmm. and if that happens, then the owners start to complain. It's the same idea.
Yeah, and also we don't know what the competing philosophies in the room are. We assume based on a couple of the guys' playing careers, but for all we know, George Parros is that guy going, this should be 10 games, or Chris Pronger could be that guy, or Patrick Burke or wherever it is, but we wouldn't know that because that all takes place in the room, and then ultimately they have to still come out with a number that fits within the range that their bosses have implicitly given them. And so,
not just their bosses though, dude. Like the other thing about this too is like people, even Ryan, like saying 10 games gets knocked down in a fucking millisecond by an arbitrator. Like the initial penalty for this was a fine, and then you go 10 games after a fine. There's no way that stands up on appeal, and that brings us back
to a repeat offender. I don't think Brock Nelson there was a thread on Twitter the other day of like, here's all the times Bortuzzo got beat by somebody and just used his stick to like take out his frustration on them.
But what the arbitrator is going to look at is the similar incidents, and there's not necessarily been a 10-game suspension for cross-checking in that manner. Like that's the issue. But to me, what my bigger point is. The thing that people seem to miss here is that for all of the heat the NHL takes, fucking give the heat to the PA. Like think about the PA exists to argue for less punishment for one player while representing the player he just put out for a month. How fucked up is that? And so, you know, these players are always talking about policing themselves. That's a buzzword we've heard for a century. Let the game police itself. Well, fucking police yourself then. Like the PA should be the one arguing for 10, 15 game suspensions for this shit because they also represent the guys getting jobbed in the back by fucking Robert Bortuzzo.
Yes. In the big picture, they should. But when it comes to I'm sorry, if your employer drops a big suspension and a big fine and takes away a bunch of your money, your union, which is what the PA is, should have your back without question if you want to go down an appeals process. I do not knock the NHLPA for supporting these guys if they choose to appeal under any circumstances, even in the cases where I don't think the appeal has any merit. That's what they're there for.
Yes.
And I don't think we should be knocking them for taking part in that. Bigger picture, in the off season when it's time to talk about this stuff, should the players be leading the charge to say, hey, let's ramp it up and make this game safer? Absolutely. Specific cases, no. They're a union. You got to have the guys back.
All right. Player safety. Oh, I was heartened to see that both Sean and I are on the same page on the asinine eye for an eye suspensions that people bring up.
That is just it's just a bad idea. Like my only, without getting into it, if you're somebody who thinks that suspension should just work by you just miss as many games as the guy is injured for, I'm just take a minute and actually think about that and how it would work and all of the nightmare scenarios that would come out of that. And then let me know if you really do think that's the best possible situation.
Yeah,
because it's like I said,
97 games is what Joe Thornton would have gotten for the hit on Perron.
Sure,
if we were doing for that. And the other thing
and Marty McSorley would have got like 3 weeks for tomahawking Donald Brashear over the head.
I mean, basically, you are determining the length of suspension by the constitution and recovery
and luck
aspects and
luck,
of a guy. Yeah. Like one guy goes out for a year and a half because of a concussion. Another guy comes back within 2 weeks. One could have been much more intentful than the other, but it doesn't matter because you're judging by the injury.
Idea? You know who really thinks that's a great idea? Miles Garrett thinks that's a fantastic idea
because
he tried to kill a dude on Thursday Night Football.
It started the next week.
and who through some miracle wasn't injured. Bad idea. I get the sentiment. I get where it's coming from. But you got to think it through. It's not a good idea.
Yeah, not at all. So there's that. Player safety. All right. Our guest today is Rachel Dorey. Now, Rachel, you may know, used to work for the New Jersey Devils. Does not anymore. We can touch on that a little bit. She has the Staff and Graph podcast. She is doing work for York University in their hockey ops department. A real up-and-comer and someone who I think is going to be working very high up in an NHL organization one day because she's brilliant. And she shares a lot of insights about how hockey operations work and then also some talk about GMs and such. And I think you'll dig it. Rachel Dorey, this is a long time coming. When we were both in New Jersey, we talked about doing this. When you were in more of a professional capacity in New Jersey.
Yes, we did.
We talked. I think I was trying to get you to go to Hobby's Deli one day, and we would just do a podcast there
in secret.
In secret, yes. Right? That's right. We're gonna do a secret podcast. Disguise your voice as we do this podcast. We are in the Intercontinental Hotel in Toronto on the day of the Hockey Hall of Fame induction, and this hotel was available because it's not a Marriott property.
Exactly. Pretty much.
So everybody who's in town for the Hall of Fame is staying at all the various Marriott properties. But you were so nice to come downtown on a rainy, shitty day in Toronto.
Oh, yeah. And people forget how to drive here when there's one snowflake on the ground. See,
that's insane to me because that is the knock I always used to give to the people in the D.C. area when I lived in Washington, which is that the minute there's an inch of snow on the ground – it's like abandon your cars. But you would figure that Canadians would be first of all, you'd figure they'd all have chains on their tires, which they don't.
You're not allowed.
You're not allowed in Canada or in Toronto?
So when I went to school in Sudbury, mm-hmm. you could have chains on your tires because I have seen people do all kinds of crazy things up there that are definitely illegal. But here, I think it has something to do with the quality of the roads. They don't want chains and stuff. But I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about it snows and you have people driving at 150 kilometers an hour. I'm like, it's snowing outside. You don't need to drive that fast.
All right. What are you doing with yourself now these days?
I'm back in school.
Uh-huh.
So I'm doing a master's and kind of just figuring out.
A master's in what? Art?
Sports science and analytics.
Oh, okay. That was my second choice.
Yes. It was a debate between a double in law and business versus the sports science analytics route. Mm-hmm. But this route kind of gives me a chance to work with both hockey teams and do some research with them. So I'm coaching with both the men's and women's hockey teams. And I'm on the ice pretty much 3 hours a day. Really enjoy it. So make hockey fun again.
Indeed. But don't put it on a hat. So the question I have for you is, we mentioned law and business, right? So one of the things that the people might remember about you or know about you and your interactions with people like me and the rest of the hockey media is that you had designs, famously, on being the first female general manager in the National Hockey League. Now, to me, if you had taken the business and law path, well, that's a giant firework in the sky that says, oh, yeah, Rachel's going to be the next female GM in the National Hockey League. Have you soured on this notion? Is it still an aim for you? You've now seen how the sausage is made. And sausage is the operative word.
Oh. Yes.
What, are you still? Because this was the thing. That was like your calling card. Much like Kyle Dubas is like, I am the analytics guy. You were on track to be the first woman to run an NHL team. Do you still want to do it?
I would say I'm not as brash on it as I was before,
mm-hmm.
But it's still something that is a dream of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Having a look behind the curtain definitely, I would say it changed my perspective and my view on the hockey world mm-hmm. a little bit, and some things that I need to work on professionally, personally, and to develop. In order to make it in the hockey world, just because of the way that the hockey world is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem to be hurriedly going in a direction that maybe doesn't require some personal development and being able to deal with difficult situations.
Right.
So for me, I think it's important that I broaden my horizon. So I already have the business background, right? Mm-hmm. That was my first degree. Mm-hmm. It's a sports business. So now being able to go and look at the analytics and sports science, I think that it would give me a better perspective on the athlete. So when potentially I get back into a front office, I have an idea of how the body works, maybe something like load management, injury prevention management, rehabilitation. I think that that's something where in hockey, it's like we have this guy playing with a punctured lung. And maybe that's not a good idea. Or this guy's playing 30 minutes a night and maybe that's not a good idea. So right. I think it just – the purpose of this master's is more to learn an entirely different side of things so that I can be more well-rounded.
Well, what if the player is Patrice Bergeron though? Is that okay then?
I mean, I would take Patrice Bergeron on my team 8 days a week.
With like no lungs.
With no lungs.
using some sort of breathing apparatus at all times.
Exactly. But yeah, I think that when you look at what's going on in the NBA and in Toronto, the famous example is Kawhi Leonard and mm-hmm. even to a degree Danny Green. I think that thinking is not really applied in hockey because it's more you should play through everything and this, that, and the other, and maybe that's not necessarily a great idea.
Do you think that's the next horizon? I mean, like, I feel like there's an acknowledgement, either superficially or seriously, that analytics are important.
Well, some people don't believe that, but
but at least most front offices seem like they've at least given it some lip service.
Yes.
But do you feel like that's the next horizon is going to be, well, we have a sports scientist on staff and they're going to tell us how many games this person should play based on their, you know, their internals. Like, is that going to be the next thing?
I think it probably should be, because I think when you are looking at building a team, you are building it on the premise of, if I get peak performance out of my athletes, this is the team that I will be.
Right.
But then you forget that you actually have to do work to get peak performance out of those athletes, and that kind of goes by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
So you're building this team on this notion, I'm going to have peak performance from my athletes. And then you don't do the work to actually get the peak performance, whether it be coaching them to a style that's conducive to success or playing them appropriate amounts of time or in appropriate situations. And that's part of the research I'm doing with York, is they've allowed me to basically have free rein of any data that I want to collect, or even like line combinations. Hey, try this and see what happens. Or maybe this guy shouldn't play 27 minutes a night.
Yeah.
And see what happens. I think that if you're going to build a team, you better make sure that people are performing or have the ability to perform. Otherwise, there's no point in building a team.
Right.
So I think
you would think that this would be one of the most popular trends that would ever come down the pike for the players. You figure the players would love this to be a thing that exists in NHL front offices. You think they'd be in favor of it, yeah?
You would think, because I think before there was this notion of, well, it still is, this I have to play through this, hockey is a tough, it's a man's sport,
yeah.
This, like all the other cliches that you can think about, right? And we're finding out that long-term, not a good idea, right? Guys are having to shorten their careers, or you play too much and then you get burnt out at the end of the year. I think Vasilevsky admitted that he kind of got burnt out. Freddie Anderson has admitted it. I can't imagine how Erik Karlsson felt in Ottawa playing nearly 40 minutes a night or whatever it was. But you would think the players would be in favor of it because there's research now that suggests that you, in order to perform at peak performance, you can't be playing past that threshold on a consistent basis, let's say. So I would say that that's probably something they'll be in favor of, even though there's still this culture of you must tough it out.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like I as soon as I said they were in favor of it, I thought to myself, except for the part where you tell them they can't play. Like that's the Rubicon that has to get crossed. It's this idea of like, no, you don't understand. Like 77 games, chef's kiss. That's exactly right for you. But I want to play 82. Well, don't, because it's not good for you. Like that's, to sell that is going to take maybe a generation to sell that.
It probably will, because when you look at it, think about the goalies. We're just in the point now where Boston runs two and the Islanders have run two. But the age of Martin Brodeur playing 73 games a year is gone.
Yeah, tell me about it.
It should be, because nobody should be playing that many games a year as a goaltender. You're going to be way too tired. Or the back-to-back. I'm not a proponent of playing a goaltender twice on a back-to-back unless they only faced like 18 shots the night before. And you know what? You probably didn't work very hard, so go ahead and go out there again.
It's defensemen, too. Like, I remember when the Hawks made all their runs and, you know, Duncan Keith would play, like, 30 minutes in a game and people would be like, oh, man, this is incredible. This is unprecedented. And then, like, Larry Robinson would pipe up and be like, no, you don't understand. In the 1980s, that was our average. You know? So, I mean, at the very least, maybe the times for some of these guys have come down since what they used to be like. We had Eddie Belfour on the ESPN podcast and he was talking about, like, oh, 74 games was the norm. And you're just like, that's nuts.
Yeah, like, your body is going to hate you when you're 60 years old.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking about goalies. We might as well talk about it because it happened only a couple hours before we did this podcast. What did you think of the Corey Schneider thing?
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I said it on my podcast and I've said it privately before. Those hip injuries are very difficult to come back from. I think probably the only example I can think of a guy who really came back from it was Pekka Rinne, and that guy's a freak mm-hmm. of athletic nature anyways.
Yeah.
Those are super detrimental to goaltending. And I just, from the chances that the Devils have been giving up, probably also not conducive to anybody who has had an injured hip. And so for me, if it depends. Like, I don't think anyone's going to pick him up. I think he needs to go down to Binghamton and really find his game. And I don't know if he can do that anymore because it's
he spent the last
not
few,
good.
He spent the last few years trying to find his game.
Like, one of the things, have much help in front of him. But.
No, he didn't. He didn't. And one of the things I remember hearing about him is that the way that the game has changed, even in the last few years offensively, where there's just so much more. I think the thing that someone once told me, one of the goalie coaches told me, was like there's so much more sort of back and forth movement in the offensive zone, and
yes.
It's such a more loosey-goosey sort of thing now that we've, you know, opened up the slot and things like that, that if you are limited in your mobility, you're like, you're fucked basically now if you're a goalie.
You're totally,
yeah.
totally screwed. And that's the thing is, laterally, before his injury, Schneider was very good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when he was acquired by the Devils, he was very good laterally. It was one of his calling cards,
mm-hmm.
right? It's probably why Luongo got pushed out in Vancouver, is because he was just so good with that lateral movement as the game started to go in that direction. As soon as you have a hip injury like that, or a groin injury, where it really inhibits your ability to push from side to side,
mm-hmm.
and now you have Royal Road passes and way more rush chances, and it's just... the game is more difficult to play. There are more scoring chances. It's not conducive. The fact that he's, I think, 33 years old also doesn't help. Like,
no,
you don't
it
get better unless your name's Brad Marchand when you're 30 years old.
You're right. And by better, you mean offensively.
Yes.
And maybe like 30. I saw another headline recently about, like, Brad Marchand has changed his attitude in his game.
Has his attitude changed, though? Because he's still a pest.
Like, it's still a thing where, like, he does things. I don't know. I guess because the bar was set at licking your opponents, that anything south of licking your opponents is now seen as, like, a behavioral change. And I'm like...
That is not a very high bar.
What a scam you pulled. Like, I'm like, I'm going to shoot a man in the back of the head. If I do anything that doesn't involve shooting a man in the back of the head, then I am a changed person.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but that's
great.
Not a very high bar.
No, it's not a very high bar at all.
I only made one racist remark. Therefore, if I move forward and don't make them anymore,
right.
It's like, what kind of bar is that?
Yeah,
how about just don't do it?
Right, don't do it, yeah. You still have that latent DNA. In a general sense, what surprised you the most about player evaluation when you were in the machine, in the NHL machine? Were you surprised, you know, were you like, you know, when somebody goes to Washington and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe how, like, seven generations behind where they should be on things they are. Like, were you like that going in there? Or?
There were some things where I'm like, okay, like eyebrow raising.
Yeah.
The one thing I give Devils ownership credit for is they actually want to be at the forefront.
There's the Sixers guys.
Yes,
they
own the 76ers, and that has a analytics department that has people with Harvard PhDs in it. So I can't even imagine what the budget is for that department. But they actually, I'll give them credit, they want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the way I look at player evaluation right now is there's still a lot of I feel this way about this player.
Mm.
This is what I feel. And I'm not like that.
Yeah.
There's one player that I feel about, and he is in the Hockey Hall of Fame, so he had to have been pretty good, is Matt Sundin.
Right.
Right? I feel a certain way about Matt Sundin. And he, lo and behold, was very good.
And the numbers would back up that.
And the numbers would back
really
that up.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas, like, oh, I can't play this guy because I feel like he's not going to be hard to play against in front of the net.
Yeah.
What do you mean you feel that way?
Yeah.
Like, where is the tangible evidence in that?
I feel like that scene in Moneyball is so it's sort of encapsulated sports for me. When he's in the room and he's spouting off numbers and the guy next to him spouting off numbers, and then the old guy at the end of the table is like, I saw a twinkle in his eyes, you know, and it's just like, how do you combat that?
Yeah. It's unbelievable. It's one of those things where it's like, if you don't understand, I'm gonna ask Pete.
Right.
Right? And he just points over there. And
but here's the thing, though. Like, is there... I know we're kind of shitting on it. But is there sort of a sports whisperer aspect to scouting where there are just some people that have that sixth sense about a person? Like, I want to believe that there's... you know, somebody who's sniffed Zamboni fumes for the last 70 years, and they just know better than you and you or I when they see a player that they're going to be that good. Because, I mean, that is kind of how it's been, and that's not to say that it's a good thing or a bad thing, but maybe there's something to it where certain people can look at a guy and be like, nah, he's not made of the stern stuff that's necessary.
The stern stuff is something that really bothered me. I'm like, yeah. Like I don't care. I don't care. But there are some things. So I think doing your background research and speaking to a number of scouts, because that's something that I had the ability to do. Mm-hmm. If you actually do your research on, never mind the numbers and their play on the ice, who they are off the ice, mm-hmm. you can get a good sense of the person they're going to develop into and if that personality is conducive to success. Because if this guy doesn't have a work ethic and doesn't show up to the rink on time and all that, like, obviously probably doesn't have the work ethic.
So when you say off the ice, you're talking about that. You're talking about the basics, like when I worked at Burger King in high school, like the people who show up on time for their shift at Burger King obviously are going to be better at the job than the people that don't.
I have spoken to scouts who have sought out their certain draft picks, peewee coaches.
Yeah.
What was this player like then versus what are they like 6-7 years later? Because you can get an idea of the growth path.
Yeah.
Right? So.
And so the thought is if you're a fuck up when you're in peewee, you're going to be a fuck up now.
Or if you're a fuck up when you're in peewee, but you're a really good individual now, you're a leader in the
right.
community, you
that's
show
what I'm saying.
Up,
yeah.
That shows a development curve.
If you're still
I can
the
get
same,
behind
the
that.
Same guy that you were in peewee, then
that's a big problem.
You're always going to be that guy.
Right. That's a pretty big issue.
I love that.
So it's going through and doing that kind of research to marry with what you see.
Yeah.
Right? To me, I'm a big, and I've always been a big proponent of, that's great that you could see it on the ice, or that's great that you can see it in the numbers in your spreadsheet or mm-hmm. in your R studio. Mm-hmm. But if you can't put it together, it doesn't matter
right.
about what you think or what you think, because one, the biggest problem we have in hockey right now, and I see it on hockey Twitter all the time, which is, it just pisses me off to no end. Nobody can get along because the analytics people are like, well, my opinion's correct because math. And the other people are like, well, my opinion's correct because eyeballs. I'm like, we have people scouting who don't have good enough eyesight to have driver's licenses. Like, sorry, but I'm not trusting your eyeballs. And then I personally have done an experiment where I can skew numbers to make pretty much anybody look good.
Yeah.
So you can skew numbers.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So unless you can get those people to work together, which hockey Twitter clearly can't do, mm-hmm. and it's even it's less so in the front office, there's still a lot of arguing, you're not going to get anywhere.
Look, I'm a troll. I want to win arguments. All you got to do is instead of going 8 games back, you go 7 games back and get that one good 8th game out of the way, and now you got 7 shitty games.
Oh, it's amazing. So,
yeah, that's all you got to do.
We were playing at York, and we've had a segment where we've been unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then our last game, we were playing one of the top teams in the country, didn't have a great game. I'm like, well, I can just throw that one out, and look how great we were. And then you yeah. add the other game, and it's all the way
right.
at the bottom of the chart.
Right. And or just,
well, just
know,
throw that one out.
Throw out that one game where the dude was Daryl Sittler. And then fucking the other ones around it are shitty. So
yeah.
obviously he's shitty.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh,
you can cherry pick to no end. And to say that people don't do that is factually incorrect. So I think until we arrive at a point where the eyeball people trust the numbers people and the numbers people trust the eyeball people, we're getting nowhere.
All right. Last topic. I asked you about this before we got on the podcast so you'd have time to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a GM that everybody thinks is shitty that's actually good? I have a name. Can I throw a name out at you and test you?
Yeah.
Pierre Dorion.
I like what he's done in Ottawa.
Yeah.
I think he has been put in a non-enviable position.
Right.
And I think what he's done, like, to me, getting Thomas Chabot to commit to the amount of years that they got him to commit mm-hmm. to, it was nothing short of a miracle.
And I remember you were huge. I remember looking back recently, and like you were really big on the Mark Stone trade, right? For them, I think.
Oh
as well.
My god, yeah,
yeah.
Eric Brännström mm-hmm. is a terrific hockey player. Like he is going to be a top four NHL defenseman. So
yeah.
that was really good for them. I forget who their first round pick was, but that, like, to me, what he's done based on the position he's in. Like, really good job.
Right.
I also think that a lot of people shit all over Joe Sakic for the Matt Duchesne fiasco.
He's turned it around.
And I don't think you can make one take one shot at him right now. The Kadri trades worked out really well for him.
Yep.
Right? And it was a UFA that he was likely going to lose. Mm-hmm. The Sam Girard situation is, I have no idea how he got him signed to that contract.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be a steal. Yeah. It's going to be like a Ryan Ellis type situation.
Especially, yeah, with what Makar is going to make.
Oh, like, my God.
You compare it to that.
And then having the confidence to draft Cale Makar there.
Yeah.
Because drafting a junior A player there is, like, not always what people would do.
Mm-hmm.
We have a guy at York who actually played with Cale Makar, and he said, like, this guy probably will win a Norris.
Yeah, it's insane.
And this was in junior A.
Yeah.
So then you have that. He's made a ton of really good moves to insulate one of the best players on earth.
All right, last question. Is it still safe to like Kyle Dubas in this city? As we do this podcast, I've arrived in Toronto at a time when the Leafs are not here, and yet everyone's still talking about them and panicking and should we fire the coach and yada, yada, yada. But I feel like there's also a certain contingent that's like maybe this kid doesn't know what he's doing. Is it safe to defend Kyle still in the city? I don't even know.
I am a big fan of Kyle.
Me too!
Like, a big fan of him. He got saddled with some certain contracts that weren't necessary. The fact that he got anything for Nikita Zaitsev and that contract is nothing short of a miracle.
Right.
Like, I know people aren't in love with Cody Ceci, but at the end of the day, you only have him for 1 year.
Yeah.
Nikita Zaitsev was going to be 5 more years of this nonsense.
It was an atrocious contract.
It was literally the worst thing ever. And Patrick Marleau, I hate to tell you, but, like, you wouldn't have Mitch Marner and the nonsense that comes along with his agent if they didn't trade Patrick Marleau. It was no choice.
Right.
He did not have a choice, and he didn't sign that contract.
Right.
That's not his problem.
Right.
He didn't hire the coach. He didn't sign those contracts, and yet here he is. He managed to get Tavares, and anyone who thinks that getting Tavares was a bad thing is, like, to me, you're a complete idiot.
And anyone who thinks that he didn't at least have a hand in getting him. I think people always just assume that, like, any of the gigantic good things that happen, it's Brendan Shanahan. And
right.
then Dubas doesn't play a role in that.
But then you look at things like having Brandon Pridham on staff, very good. The sports science department, he brought in Dr. Meg Popovich, and she does a lot of the mental health performance of the athlete, and that's super important. And there's not a lot of teams in the NHL that do that. There's a massive sports science department. Like, he's building things. He's very process-oriented, very much like the 76ers, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people need to really take it down a few notches.
Mm-hmm.
Even with the coach, too. Like, everyone remember where this team was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And take a deep, long, soothing breath with the vitriol being directed. Like, I understand, you know what, you don't always agree with things that Mike Babcock does, and neither do I.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? There's a lot more dynamics having been behind the curtain that you need to contend with than what you see. Like, I saw people trying to fire John Hines 3 games into the year. I'm like, whoa, everyone settle down.
It might have been me.
Yeah, it might have been you.
And then the Babcock thing, obviously, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. Like, when you walk into the locker room and not see Nick Lidstrom there, then obviously it's different for Mike Babcock than it used to be.
Well, I'm looking for a Nick Lidstrom. Yes, well, I hate to tell you this, but you won't find one.
Is John Hines a good coach?
Yes.
Am I wrong about John Hines?
I would work for John Hines without a second thought.
You'd run through that wall for John Hines?
Yeah.
Okay.
100%.
If you're saying it, I believe you. Because I also think that maybe his system sometimes yields too many shots, and it's a little loosey-goosey, and maybe defensively they get a little wonk.
Interesting is he doesn't want to play like that, and this is what I was talking about with Babcock on Twitter the other night.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you put Scotty Bowman behind the bench.
Mm.
If the players want to do their own thing and not listen
right.
in the same way that maybe they're doing in New Jersey, it doesn't matter what's coming out of your mouth. You could tell them the sky's purple. They're not going to listen.
But then why don't you bring in someone that'll make them listen? That's the question, I guess.
There are some players who, no matter what, are on their own page.
Right. Oh, that's my phone. All right.
It is your phone.
Say where you're working and where people can find your stuff.
Staff and Graph Podcast is available on Spotify and Google Play and wherever you find your podcasts. I'm going to be at a bunch of analytics conferences, perhaps presenting. I don't know. We'll see. But if you really want to actually find me and talk to me, you can find me at York University at Camlin Ice Sports, because that's basically where I live now.
Rachel, I tried to finish this before my radio hit in Tennessee, but now I'm on the phone with them, so we're going to have to end. Thank you for joining me. I'm Puck Soup.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Rachel Dory for joining us. If there was anything in that interview that was a little outdated, it's because we did it Hall of Fame week. Lots happened since then. So there's that. Lots happened also in the NHL standings since we last talked to you.
Yeah, no kidding.
Where
Jesus Christ.
All of a sudden, shit's gone crazy. The San Jose Sharks, obviously because Radim Šimek came back, according to all the people I mentioned, are going batshit. They're 9-1 in their last 10. They're now in the second wild card, having moved ahead of Vegas with a victory. An overtime. It was an overtime victory, right?
I think they've won 4 straight in overtime or a shootout.
Yes,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so. They're not winning in regulation. They're still -10 on the goal differential. But by God, they're a playoff team as we speak today. I think that has a lot to do with, for the most part, Martin Jones having played well. I think it has to do with an incredible run of home games and games against opponents against whom that they're gonna find some pretty decent success. But there's no question that we talked about this on the show many weeks ago, like when they were in Suckville. They're one of those teams that you could see rolling off 10 straight great games.
Yeah, they're just
and getting
super
right back
like
into
they're
it.
Talented throughout the lineup. You know, when you can play 52 minutes a night of Erik Karlsson and Brent Burns. You know, like, those guys are maybe struggling this year more than you would expect, but they're still fucking Erik Karlsson and Brent Burns.
Here you go. Ready? Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 home games and 3 road games since November 1st.
Yeah.
Gee, I wonder how the fuck they pulled it all together. Also, at Anaheim was a win. At the Kings was a win. These are obviously two teams the Sharks are quite comfortable playing against. The win at Vegas was impressive at the time, but Vegas is in the shits right now.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, an overtime win over the Islanders, legit. The Islanders are playing super great hockey.
Well, their streak just ended last night, too.
Yeah, and Barry Trotz got salty, too, about it, like talking about some guys that aren't holding up their end of the deal. But again, like, if you're looking for why the Sharks have turned things around, for all of you Šimek stans, I appreciate the snark. When I made the comment about how the Sharks were playing like they were waiting for someone to get back from injury, I was clearly talking about them offensively looking for that one goal they weren't getting from like a Joe Pavelski type. But if you want to say that Šimek has saved the season, by all means, that's fine. It's not the fact that they played a billion home games and Martin Jones stopped being a fucking disaster. It's because a defenseman came back to their like second or third pairing. That's completely what it is.
Yeah, 100%. You know what? You say that, Greg. It's because you don't watch 82 Sharks games a year, and that's why you just missed the value Radek Šimek provides.
He's fine. Like,
and look, if we want to talk about providing value, folks.
There it is.
Oh, shit. Jesus.
You're gonna want to go to SeatGeek because, look, there's no better place to get tickets to millions of live events, from sports and live music to comedy and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place, and this is where we get into the value. It rates every seat in its system on a scale of 1 to 10 and shows you on an interactive seat map of the arena. There are big green dots. The bigger and greener, the better the deal. And the little red dots, overpriced. You don't maybe want to plunk down the money for them. So that way, you don't have to like, oh, am I getting a good deal here or on this ticket or on this ticket? You just find the perfect seat. You get to enjoy it right away. Every purchase, guys, fully guaranteed. So you can shop with confidence. And that's a big part of the reason why SeatGeek has, you guys ready for this one? Over 50,000 five-star reviews. I looked at the comma wrong. And SeatGeek just, you know, they do a great job with their app, their service. And, you know, I've used it many times to get Celtics tickets. And, you know, me and my buddies are going to a game, like I said, in a couple of weeks here. And I'm very excited about it. So, look, what you got to do, SeatGeek, not only is it a great deal right up front, but Puck Soup here is going to give you $10 off your first purchase if you use our promo code SOUP. That's S-O-U-P, and it's $10 off your first purchase at checkout. And, you know, SeatGeek, you're gonna be able to find tickets to just about anything with it and get a good deal. So sign up, get the app, all that stuff.
Beautiful.
All that stuff. Nicely done. We should also mention that the Dallas Stars are also doing pretty good for themselves too these days.
Yeah,
it's
Dallas Stars are second in the Central, 9-0-1 in their last 10.
And also the Tampa Bay Lightning, technically by points percentage, back in the playoffs already.
They're
points behind because they've played like five fewer games because the schedule maker was drunk this year. And we're just apparently going to do this all year long where there's huge gaps in games played. But, yeah, points percentage.
Yeah, well,
already back.
You want to talk about it. I think they only have six more road games in the calendar year. So, like, they're going to – it feels like they're going to really rack up a bunch of really huge W's.
Good time.
They've scored 40 goals in their last 8 or 9 games, I want to say, is the number.
Yeah, and
like,
two of those games are
crazy.
Two of those games were without Stamkos as well. He didn't play last night in their puck line covering victory over the Buffalo Sabres. Thank you, Greg, for that pick. I guess who's back? Back again. Nikita Kucherov with 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 points in his last 7 games, I think it is.
That's
so, yeah.
For him, that's not that impressive, honestly.
No, that's what's crazy about it. But, yeah, so they're back in effect. The Stars are looking great. You know, the fucking Sharks are on the upswing. Everything is going pretty good. And then, you know, as a Devils fan, I'll just, you know, sit back here and sit on my hands for a while. Although they did win their last game, I guess I should say.
They've won a couple or gotten points at least in a few games recently, right? So, hey.
Yeah, well, I mean, the team that I'm really interested by is Vegas. Like, Vegas might be veering into that might need to make a trade territory juice this.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing that it was part of the problem in Toronto. I think the players all kind of like the coach there, but you know, they don't have a backup goalie. Their backup goalies are like all below 880 something. They haven't won a single game with a backup starting. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. So I mean, like, that's whatever it is, like 7, 8 points, 9 points left on the table at the very least. Like, even if you just went 500 in those games, you'd be doing a lot better. So yeah, that's their real problem, is they just can't get a fucking save from their backups.
I also wanted to bring up something that I know that you're pounding the fucking drum on, which is Cale Makar to be Calder, Norris, and Hart Trophy winner in his rookie season, which would be fucking amazing.
Well, again, right. I haven't looked in a few days, but at the time I said it last week, he was leading the league in WAR. And you know, you can obviously say part of that is he gets to play with Nathan MacKinnon, but nobody's dinging Leon Draisaitl for getting to play with Connor McDavid or vice versa, right? Like, just good players play well together. His numbers are unbelievable. He's scoring a ton since Rantanen and Landeskog got injured, and now it looks like Rantanen's closer to coming back. So
Landeskog has got a weird, like, I guess he just got reevaluated or something for that injury. He's been on the shelf for a bit.
Yeah, he has. But yeah, Makar's had a fucking unbelievable, like, I don't think Calder should even be up for discussion if he keeps playing anything like this and doesn't get hurt.
A little gentleman by the name of Jack Hughes that would like a word with you, sir.
Didn't Kaapo Kakko recently pass him in scoring?
He did.
Yeah, okay.
He did.
Makar is playing north of a point a game as a 21-year-old rookie. He seems to be good the full 200 feet. It's not like he's just putting up a ton of points. He didn't score in his last game, but before that he had, let's see here, 14 points in his previous 8. So, like, this kid is playing out of his mind. And, yeah, you know, rookies will often hit a wall, especially rookie defensemen, around the 60-game mark. You know, it's a natural thing. He's never played that many games in a season before. He played college last year. I think he probably only played 40, something like that.
Well, clearly what they need to do is shut him down after 60 games and help Patrice Bergeron on his way to an NHL award. That's all.
There it is.
Hey, man, it's all about load management in the NHL these days, right?
Oh, God. Did you see Al Morgani's tweet this week about how Keith Yandel getting a bunch of teeth knocked out and then still playing to keep his streak alive as an argument against load management?
Right.
For fuck's sake.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, you want to talk about load management, you know who should be doing it. It's the Edmonton Oilers. because,
yeah, right?
Because they're just like, Connor, Leon, you guys are going to play 4.5 out of every 5 overtime minutes we have the entire rest of the season, just so you guys know. And it's like, yeah that works if you're going to rest them for, like, you know, I don't know, 6 of the last 12 games. If you're just going to leave them out of the lineup, yeah, okay. But
then it works, yeah.
But they probably won't be able to.
What's the more fucked up stat, that the Calgary Flames are currently shooting around 7.5%, which is tied for last in the league as far as shooting percentage, or is the more fucked up stat that the Nashville Predators currently have a team save percentage of .884? What's the more fucked up stat?
It's probably the Predators, but the Flames one is my favorite because I follow the analytics guys who post their little graphs and charts every morning, and it's been fun to watch them descend into madness as the Flames continue to break all of their charts. And I think Sean Tierney's just given up. He's like, screw it, I'm not changing the axis anymore. Like, and so you just get this chart with like a little third of a Flames logo way off to one side, just like sadly peeking in, like the one kid with measles who's not invited to the party with everybody else. And it just it amuses me to see them out there just ruining graphs.
Graph ruiners. All right, now it's time for a favorite department on this show. Mm-hmm. It is time for another Puck Soup quiz. The boys, as per usual, have no idea what the quiz is. Quizmaster Wyszynski has the helm on this one, folks. As you know, Thursday is American Thanksgiving.
Is it?
We say that out of respect to Sean. Yeah, we say that out of respect to Sean.
I hadn't heard.
And part of the tradition for American Thanksgiving, along with gluttonous meals and terrible football, is the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York City, which I've attended on multiple occasions and have found it to be a joyous experience. They may not necessarily have the balloons this year, they said, because of wind, unfortunately, but still it's a good time because you have all of these incredible floats, which brings us to our quiz. Today's Puck Soup quiz is called Turkey or Jerky. I'm going to give you the description for a float in the 2019 Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. You tell me if, in fact, it is in the Turkey Day Parade or if I'm just jerking your chain. Turkey.
When you said floats, I thought we were going to do a quiz about Alex Kovalev. Listen, folks.
Oh, hey, damn. Yo. You know, that's nationalist. Is that the word I'm looking for? Culturalist? Turkey or jerky is the quiz, so you tell me whether this float will in fact roll on Thanksgiving Day in the Macy's Parade or if I just made it up. So here we go. Who goes first?
I'm on a losing streak, so I think Ryan's got the option here.
All right. Lambert, you going to kick or receive?
I'll receive. Why not?
Well, here we go. This is a good question to start with if Lambert's taking the first question. Rexy in the City by handbag maker Coach, as a giant T-Rex skeleton in a top hat tours Manhattan. Turkey or jerky?
I'm going to say jerky.
That's a turkey right there. Coach, in fact, has created a float where a giant T-Rex skeleton is touring Manhattan in a top hat. That's an actual float in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade this year.
Cool.
Rexy in the City. Get it? Correct. Like Sex in the City?
Except
it's like Rexy in the City?
Doesn't really work.
But. Oh my god.
Sean.
Yes.
Tackle Your Turkey by Butterball. A float featuring NFL Hall of Famers Michael Strahan, Warren Sapp, and Mean Joe Green running around trying to tackle a mechanical turkey. Turkey or jerky? Does this float exist?
Boy, you know, you had me until the running around trying to tackle the turkey. That feels like just logistically it would be difficult. And if it's Michael Strahan, the turkey would just lay down and let him get a free. So I'm going to say jerky. I don't think that's real.
That is correct. That float does not in fact exist.
My tip off was that all those guys probably have TV duties that day. Terry Bradshaw certainly would.
I always like when you guys start picking apart the questions to find out what's inside. I like it. Ryan, Land O'Lakes salute to butter. complete with dancing corn cobs and biscuits, and a performance by singer Megan All About the Bass Trainer. Turkey or jerky?
That sounds too stupid to be fake, so it's real.
No, that's fake. Land O'Lakes, in fact, does not have a salute to butter in this one. And Megan Trainor, from what I can gather, is not performing in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
I wanted to know if like the dancing corn cobs like started that way, or if they were just people on Twitter who got owned so badly.
Okay.
Transformed. Slowly transformed into...
By the way, boys, biscuits, do you like a traditional buttermilk circle biscuit or a flaky croissant biscuit type deal for Thanksgiving?
Buttermilk, let's go.
All right. I like a flaky croissant.
I like my biscuits in podcast form.
Oh, fuck,
never heard of it.
Come on.
I don't know what that is.
Oh.
Brackets, lozosai. Monster, okay, Sean, yep. Monster Energy Drinks, Let Your Monster Loose, with dancing drink cans wearing spooky Halloween masks, and a performance by American Idol winner Taylor Hicks. Turkey or jerky?
I mean, Let Your Monster Loose sounds absolutely real. Taylor Hicks? See, once again, I was on board until the very end. But no, I'm going to say that's real. That's turkey.
No, that's a turkey. Taylor Hicks, I don't believe is a big enough name to be in the Macy's Thanksgiving.
Well, and also he doesn't like the Monster Energy drink is more your corns. Your
yes.
Your insane clown posse
has to be available.
Oh god. An ICP float in the Thanksgiving Day Parade for all you juggalos out there. Boy, that would have been pretty dope. Shaggy 2 dope, if you will. Ryan, most valuable mom, a float that celebrates hockey moms.
100%
giant-
yes. This is, you don't need, like, of course, 100% yes.
Let me finish.
Oh, okay.
With a giant turkey goalie and a performance by the Black Eyed Peas.
Yes.
Yes, that's absolutely right. That is actually the NHL float this year.
Ugh.
A salute to hockey moms.
Wow.
Giant turkey goalie. And before we get really impressed that it's the Black Eyed Peas, please keep in mind it's the Black Eyed Peas without Fergie. She's no longer in the Black Eyed Peas. So it's just like the three dudes with funny names.
Oh, see, I didn't know that. I was impressed.
Yeah, Fergie is the draw of the Black Eyed Peas. We all agree with that.
What? Well, it's a bit like saying the NHL got No Doubt to play, except it's not Gwen Stefani.
Well, then no,
it's
because Gwen Stefani is like the main person in No Doubt. Like, I don't think of Fergie as being the main person from the Black Eyed Peas. They existed both before and after her in
that's
in
a
the band.
Fair point. That's a
Apple
fair point.
The Gap is there.
Yeah,
the other one,
Will I Am, who also was in Wolverine Origins. Like, I agree with that, because the first Black Eyed Peas song that I remember liking was Joints and Jams, and Fergie had fuck all to do with that song. So I completely understand what you're trying to say. My No Doubt comparison was a bit
foolish. I agree.
Hyperbolic.
Ridiculous.
Is the word I would use.
You guys have much stronger feelings about the Black Eyed Peas than I would have imagined.
Here's the thing. I could name two of them, and one of them is the person I think is not important to the band. So...
Sean, yes. as this is a fucking barn burner of a quiz, we're tied 1-1. Ooh. Tough guy and a giant inflatable felon with a shaved head, tiny hat, and prison tattoos. Turkey or jerky?
Just because? Just we're celebrating prison time? See, this is where my lack of historical knowledge of the Macy's Parade is going to hurt me.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys get the Macy's Parade up in Canada?
No,
by the way?
I mean, we get American TV channel, so if it's on, I'm sure we get it, but nobody would
they're
watch it.
They're just at work.
Yeah, we're waiting for the football game to start, and I don't like there wasn't my understanding of America is that there needs to be like a business associated with this. Like that doesn't sound. I don't think you can make any money off some tattooed felon. So I'm going to say jerky. I don't think that's real.
Well, first of all, those license plates aren't going to make themselves. So you can make some money off
it. Yeah, especially when you pay them 4 cents an hour.
Yeah, exactly. No, tough guy is real. One of the tricaloons, which is a balloon strapped to a tricycle. He has been part of the parade since 2011. He is a giant felon with a top, a little hat, and tattoos. He's a tough guy.
All right. Well,
four questions left, and we are tied 1-1. This is very exciting. Ryan, Star Wars The Float, shaped like the adorable droid BB-8 and featuring dancing Kylo Ren's, with a performance by Liam Payne of One Direction.
I'm going to say no, because it would be the Knights of Ren dancing and not Kylo Ren himself. So I'm going to say no.
Yeah. That's very impressive. You go to Disney World, you do see like Darth Vader dancing and shit. It's not like he sends out his minions because he's above it all. It's kind of how it works.
Well, he definitely is above it all.
But you're right, though. That is a fake float. There is no Star Wars float. Liam Payne of One Direction is not performing on it. And there will be no dancing Kylo Ren's, much to my chagrin. Sean.
Yes.
Mount Rushmore the Float, dancing stone faces of some of our greatest dead presidents, with a performance by country music star Chris Young.
Okay, I've never heard of that country music star, but that doesn't really help me one way or another. This sounds like something, this sounds very American. I'm going to say, I'm going to say that one is whatever I'm supposed to say when it's true.
You're supposed to say turkey, and you're correct. That is actually a real thing in the parade. Yeah. Mount Rushmore the Float.
Huh.
Ryan.
Yeah.
Two questions left, buddy. This is very exciting. Lady Liberty, a giant inflatable Statue of Liberty who shoots gravy out of her torch.
I think the shooting gravy is what makes this a little bit implausible. I'm going to say that's jerky.
That is correct. No. There is no Lady Liberty shooting gravy out of her torch.
So what I really like about this is how much Greg seems to have started mailing in the fake ones. He's like, I came up with three really good fake ones, and then the rest have fuck it, who cares?
I mean, not inaccurate, per se. Okay. Sean, here it is, buddy. We're either going to overtime or we're not. Baby dinos. Three newborn apatosauruses that are sponsored in a macabre turn by the Sinclair Oil Corporation. Turkey or jerky?
See, I'm pausing here because I figure, like, I should be able to get a tell off of Ryan here on whether there was anything factually incorrect or disqualifying about that description of dinosaurs. But he's gone silent. He's not giving me anything. This is like a poker stare down, except I'm trying to do it over the phone. It's not working very well. Okay. Baby, can I get it read to me again, Greg? Can I hear it one more time?
Sure, absolutely.
Right. Use it in a sentence.
Baby dinos, yeah. As three newborn apatosauruses are sponsored in a macabre turn by the Sinclair Oil Corporation.
That is pretty macabre. I'm going to say turkey. I think it's true. Sure.
That is absolutely correct, wow. Sean.
Yeah.
That is a real float in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
Sinclair's logo is an apatosaurus. That's why I knew that was true.
Yeah.
Okay.
So now the tiebreaker. It's a fucking Price is Right rules. So the closest without going over. Okay. Closest without going over. Even though they may not fly because of high winds, how many balloons are scheduled to be in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in 2019? Closest without going over.
Uh, 55.
Okay. Sean?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'll say 54.
Well,
why would you do that?
No, wait, that was it.
It's
that
too late. He's locked in.
Yeah, that was the wrong. Yeah.
I shouldn't have said Price is Right rules because you're both grossly overestimating how many balloons are in this fucking thing.
Really?
See, the Price is Right rules, that just lets the second 30.
That's, all right, here we go.
I was thinking 30,
okay,
but that was
so
Vegas.
No Price is Right.
Wait, we're not done?
No Price is Right rules. Closest to the T.
How many of these do you have?
Many,
how do we get
how many
this?
Floats are there in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade this year?
30.
Closest to the T. 54.
I'm going to say 29.9.
The number of floats in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade this year is 34.
Thank you,
Lambert, ladies and gentlemen. You're an incredible winner. Thanks. I mean, again, a little bit of unfairness here because the American did win the Thanksgiving quiz. But the American Thanksgiving quiz. But
yeah, we didn't do the Canadian Thanksgiving quiz.
Are there Canadian Thanksgiving parades?
No.
Why is that, do you think?
Because why would you have a parade for Thanksgiving?
That sell your stupid bullshit.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, to sell your bullshit, right.
We don't even know what day Canadian Thanksgiving is on. We're not gonna be holding parades.
I mean, how else is the NHL going to let people know that they love moms and the Black Eyed Peas, if not through the Thanksgiving Day Parade?
The famous thing I associate with the NHL, the Black Eyed Peas. Sure.
I forget what year they started doing these floats, the NHL, but by God, they've done
it
a few times.
It was around the time of the second NBC deal, the re-up.
Yeah, right, because NBC is they play up the parade in a pretty big way. They do it it's kind of their thing, you know?
Yeah.
So that might be accurate. I do remember they would have players on it, like Bobby Orr would be on it and stuff.
Again, you great know? Way to sell the game in 2018 or whatever. Just
well, I
get
mean,
a bunch
the
of
other
old
players,
guys out there.
The other players are busy. I mean, isn't Friday like Hockey Day in America or some bullshit?
Yeah, so
isn't
get
what they
some.
Do?
Well, I feel like what if there were teams that were playing in New York? Could we maybe get
Here
them
go.
To go?
So this is the official description of the float. On this floating rink, kids get to test their slap shot skills against the giant turkey goalie. Escorting them down the route are the most viable hockey moms. They exemplify what it means to be team players and support the ones you love. Mass Mutual and the NHL celebrate moms who go above and beyond every day. Note, although it is made of synthetic ice, the rink's hard surface allows for real skating. And the Black Eyed Peas are playing on the float, as we mentioned earlier, but no Fergie. There you go.
Sounds fantastic.
Very exciting. All right, that's Puck Soup for this week. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We will talk to you next week. Thanks to Rachel Dorey. Thanks to Manscaped and SeatGeek for sponsoring this nonsense. And when next we talk to you, we'll probably know what happened to Bill Peters. So a cliffhanger, if you will, in this episode. All right, I'm Greg Wyshynski. You can find my stuff on ESPN, the annual What in Hockey We're Thankful For column drops this Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. So do check that out. Got a disparate collection of people from around the hockey world to contribute this year, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, you can find my stuff on Yahoo and also sign up for the Puck Soup newsletter, which I do every week, except on weeks where we record an episode of Stick to Sports, my podcast with Sean Gentile, and we do that once a month, and we just did it this past Saturday. So lots of talk about movies. We had both seen The Irishman, so we got to talk about that a little bit. And yeah, good show. We like doing it, so sign up.
You can find me on The Athletic, and it's kind of a cool week for The Athletic. They're doing a site-wide thing. Look back at the decade of the 2010s, and Wednesday is hockey day, so we're going to have a whole bunch of stuff for individual teams and for the league as a whole. I've got my top 10 trades of 2010s, And I've also got my 10 dumbest moments in the NHL in the 2010s, which I can tell you took a lot of work to narrow down. the honorable mentions is like roughly 800 words. So it's
that's this week, yeah. Like AKA Thanksgiving week, or next week?
That is this week, like as in probably tomorrow by the time awesome. You hear this, is all the NHL stuff.
Brilliant. Super fun. Yeah, that's a cool, and obviously The Athletic, with having writers in every city, I'm sure there'll be like all-time teams and shit like that too. So
yeah, so your favorite team, all-time teams, top games, top moments, top stories, all of that stuff. But yeah, they gave me the trades and the dumb stuff, which is a case of knowing the strengths and weaknesses of your people.
Well, there you go. Do check out The Athletic for all that stuff this week. That should be a lot of fun. All right, that's the show for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will talk to you soon. Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slapshots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part 2.